Okay. Our next talk is going to be about BPF as a revolutionary technology for the container landscape by Daniel Borkman. He's one of the BPF kernel maintainers. And let's start it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the introduction. And it's really great to see so many people here that the room is fully packed. So first off, I want to start with the container landscape. It's, I guess, obvious to everyone that containers exist for a long time. But like, how do the production deployments look like? And I found a nice usage report from Systic folks where they looked into various aspects. And I picked out three points from there. One is that I found very interesting and as a trend. And one is the lifetime of a container. And we can see here that there's a continuously decreasing lifetime. Many of the containers seem to run, as you can see here on the chart, for 10 seconds or less. And that basically doubled over the last year. And that trend seems to be increasing. The other thing is how many containers are running on a, I hope you can see the numbers good here, how many containers are running on one single node. And that number also has doubled from the last year, and now it seems to be 30 as a median. And the last one, I guess it's pretty obvious, but what is the main orchestrator if you deploy containers? And that's Kubernetes. So in including, if you include OpenShift and Rancher here as well, then it's 89%. So that's quite vast majority. And as a common denominator, as a common base platform for all of this is, of course, the Linux kernel. And it has to provide all the building blocks that we know for the isolation in terms of namespaces. So you have various namespaces, network namespaces. Recently, time namespace got merged into the kernel. And also for resource management, which is done through the C groups. It has to provide the network connectivity in case of the network namespaces. It's either through Weave devices, IPVLAN devices, or various others. And security policies that you can implement and that can be done in terms of Linux security modules or firewall policies and so on and so forth. And all of this also has to withstand all the increasing scalability needs and the higher churn frequencies of containers, while also coping with the subsystems that exist for a very long time in the kernel, for 10 years or more, and that have been designed back then. And of course, the Linux kernel has the paradigm of never break user space. So all of this has to still keep working while you optimize all of it. And just to pick out two examples in networking. So there's TC and IPTables NetFilter. They both have been designed long ago. And they're both generally extensible. But at the same time, their framework is inflexible for today's needs because in case of TC and the IP tables, like the whole processing pipeline is part of the API contract with user space. For example, TC has classifiers and actions. You can load them, and you really have to specify how the packet is processed. If it doesn't hit this classifier, then you create another classifier instance. And if it matches this, then you have to go through this action. And similarly with IP tables, you basically, in the worst case, end up traversing like a linear list of rules that you have. And yeah, so if it's getting really complex, then basically it slows down your fast path because it's sitting right in the middle of it. And system software today basically has to support the right range of kernels because people in production are running old kernels or the latest kernels. Ideally, we would love that everybody's running the latest stable, but that's like not always the case, and then basically you end up baking policy in like deeply into your code base, and there's significant effort if you want to rewrite it. Just a random pick in libnetwork, it basically encodes the arguments for later on shelling out to IP tables, and it's not really great. And I found this KCD where it says, yeah, to itself, to the future self, if you want to fix it, you have to rewrite it. And it's kind of creepy, but yeah. Not only libnetwork, but also Kubernetes relies a lot on IP tables, specifically for its service implementation through kubeproxy. And they are also issues in terms of scalability. So some of them are, for example, low and unpredictable packet latency, because if you have many different services and the way that IP tables is basically programmed and traversed, you end up either hitting the first rule, which is really the best case, or you have to traverse all the different rules, and then you end up at the last one, and that's not really a nice outcome. And there are slow update times because you have to replace the entire blob of rules, and this can really take a long time if the kernel has to pause and make sense of it and basically install the rules into the data path. There are also reliability issues. I will get to that in a bit, and inflexibility because what I mentioned in terms of the contract with user space. In terms of performance, even when you do like basic measurements from host to host, you will see that in a lot of cases, even with just a very few rules in the kernel, if you run perf top to see what are the heaviest hitters in terms of CPU cycles that are consumed, that it's often case IP tables. And there are also other issues. So probably many of you that run Kubernetes in production might have hit this bug where you got basically DNS delays of 5 seconds or more because of a connection tracking race. My colleague, Martinez, he submitted actually a patch in August 2018, but the patch got only merged like around half a year later. And he even did some research, like the first occurrence in the bug was actually in 2010 that people were hitting it. It's fixed now, which is really good, but like until it really goes down all the way downstream to users in production, it takes a lot of time actually. There are also some other issues along the way. For example, I copied here the documentation from Kubernetes for kubeadmin. So now IP tables is being replaced with NF tables, but they're basically issues with the don't break user space part where they recommend that you should run the old IP tables binary and don't upgrade because rules are getting installed twice, which breaks kubeproxy. In terms of debuggability, if you only have a few rules, that's good. I think that's fairly easy to follow. You can also see like the counters if you write IP tables save-c. So it's easy to debug, but if you have a lot of rules, for example, here in the left side, we deployed basically 100 services only, all with the same backend, but that already gets complex to follow like where my packet is dropped, right? And the other thing is also that kubeproxy periodically resets the counters in IP tables, so yeah, good luck with debugging. It's to show you the basic packet flow, basically you have an SKB at the beginning. It hits the TC ingress path, and then later on, all the yellow boxes are NetFilter related. You do a FIP lookup, and then if you want to push the packet back out the kernel, you hit the TC egress path, and then you send it to the device. And just to show you an example how kubeproxy installs the rules with IP tables so that you have a clearer picture of it. If you, for example, create a service, Nginx in this case, which has a virtual cluster IP of 3333, and it has two endpoints, then basically how it looks like in IP tables, that's the way how kubeproxy installs it. It basically first creates a rule in the NAT table for the pre-routing where you redirect all the new traffic to the kube services chain. And then basically there you will check for the virtual IP. And if that's happening and if that matches, you basically go to the kube service Nginx. And there you have like a random selector with the probability of 2 because you have two backends. And then you either select the first one or the second. And then basically packet goes on, right? And if you have many, many rules, you basically have to first match on all of the service IPs before you end up at the right one. But you can actually optimize this path by only going from TC ingress to TC egress with the help of eBPF. I first mentioned in the beginning that TC also has issues in terms of with exposing the processing pipeline, but the module that we wrote for eBPF basically bypasses this because you can do all of it in eBPF and then directly return a verdict without having to process many, many TC rules there. So it's actually efficient. And I would say it's probably the only efficient module that is there in the TC software path. How does it work, basically? So you have a piece of code. It's similar. It's C-like syntax. You can compile it with LLVM. LLVM has a BPF backend. And that generates an object file. There's a BPF loader in user space, for example, IPRO2, or there's libBPF, which is maintained in the Linux kernel tree as well. And it basically creates the maps. It links the maps into the BPF program. And in the end, it calls a syscall for loading the program. Then it, in the kernel, it goes through a verifier. Verifier makes sure that everything is safe and sound. And then basically, it hits the just-in-time compiler where it translates BPF instructions into native CPU instructions. And basically, all major kernel architectures, they have support for JIT these days. And then it creates native code. And basically, your user space agent that you have can access BPF maps to update state at runtime or to fetch state from the BPF program if it wrote into maps. And again, like if traffic is coming, then it hits the BPF code and it can either redirect it to another device or basically can drop the packet. That's also possible. And an agent itself can also like periodically update BPF programs. So that's, that's the basic workflow there. And so, yeah, so why is BPF a radical shift? Because you can get full programmability, right? So it allows you to, it allows the user to tinker and to change the kernel data path in any way it wants, but still with the safety belt on. It's not like kernel modules where you can potentially crash the kernel. So I've been talking a lot about networking, and this whole talk is actually about container networking here. But it's also there are also different areas like tracing and security. Tracing, you probably heard a lot from Brandon Gregg, where he's doing great work there. And security, there are recently proposals for Linux security modules to make it programmable with BPF as well. In the networking, it allows you to fully define the forwarding pipeline, which is great. And the thing is, like BPF has a stable API guarantee, so it's pretty much similar to syscalls, where we don't break it once it works and the verifier passes. And the other thing is you get native speed, so it's similar to kernel modules there. You can update your BPF programs live at runtime without having to reboot anything, without having to even tear down services, so it works without service disruption. And it's really designed for performance and production use cases, right? BPF is basically developed mainly by Facebook and some folks from our side, Google, Red Hat, Cloudflare, many, many people, and it's really great that there are so many contributors. There's really a long tail of 287 contributors in the kernel since the beginning, and there are also large-scale users of it. So Facebook is running it in production on all of their infrastructure. Whenever you hit facebook.com, you will go to BPF. Netflix are using it on a large scale for tracing. Google is using it in terms of traffic shaping to optimize their TCP stack and many others. Cloudflare folks, they're using it for their load balancer and DDoS protection in production. And it's even available on RHEL kernels, which means something because it probably means now it's mainstream because people are backporting it to RHEL, which is a good thing. And yeah, and even like the old IP tables maintainer, Rusty Russell, he admits that, yeah, IP tables used to be good enough. But these days, it needs a radical shift, and that's basically BPF, right? So how does this all link back to Kubernetes networking? So basically, there's Solium, which is an open source project. It's a CNI for Kubernetes, and it implements its full data path in BPF. It supports the Kubernetes service implementation, which is the focus of this talk, but there's also many other things there, network policies, multi-cluster accessibility, encryption, and so on and so forth. So you can look it up. It's all open source on GitHub. So how did we get to the path in Solium of replacing kubeproxy with BPF, where you can basically then end up deleting the kubeproxy daemon set and don't have... you don't even need your long list of IP table rules anymore then. So basically, to give you an overview of what kubeproxy does, you basically have different services. One is called cluster IP, Cluster IP basically allows you an in-cluster access of a virtual IP, where basically you can either access this from a pod or from the host namespace. There are services which are called node ports, which allow the access from outside, but also at the same time from inside. You can view it as an onion. So for example, the node port also makes use of cluster IP. And yeah, there's also external IP, which means you have an access to an external IP. You can basically override it with your own backends. It also, again, works on top of node port. And there's, last but not least, a load balancer service, which is usually when you have an external cloud provider and then it redirects packets to your either external IP or node port services so you can access it from the outside world, right? And in Cilium, basically, in prior versions, we implemented the whole thing in BPF the following way, like the cluster IP, if you have port-to-port connectivity, if you basically connect to a virtual IP, like going back to the 333 example from previous slides with the Nginx service, you basically have your own pod here, which has its own network namespace. You connect to it through Weave devices, and basically on this side, you're hitting the TC ingress path in the host namespace, and basically there BPF is attached. And what it does inside BPF, in the BPF program, is basically a service map lookup. It checks whether there's an endpoint for that address, and then it does the DNAT on the back end in BPF. It creates a connection tracking entry so that it can make sure that the replies are coming back in and are translated correctly. And here you can see like the content basically of a service map. It has different backends encoded here. And for the connection tracker, we can basically make sure that whenever replies come back in, that there's a connection tracking entry, it will hit it, it will do the reverse net and go back to the original client. So yeah, that's like the basic path. And how is this all plumped down from Kubernetes to Cilium? Basically, Cilium listens to events from the Kube API server. And whenever there are service updates, it listens to it, for example, here, and then backend updates, and then it basically pushes this down into this BPF service map that is sitting in the data path, right? So recently we reworked the cluster IP access with something even more efficient. So the Linux kernel has support for attaching BPF programs to Cgroup v2. There are different ways you can attach to it. So just to walk you through it, so if a client, again, connects to an Nginx service, then basically we already attach to the connect syscall, and we can see that the client is trying to access one of the service IPs. We can already do the map lookup right from there. And then we can basically rewrite the destination address to one of the backends. And that's much more efficient because you don't have to do actual DNAT. You don't have to mangle packets in the data path. You can just rewrite the address that was used to pass down for the connect system call. So basically, the kernel. It looks like as if the application directly connects to the backend, but it's still like the kernel makes it think that it's actually connecting to the service IP, right? And the same for connected UDP. So there's connected UDP and unconnected UDP in the kernel, and you can do the same there from the connect hook. And if you have unconnected UDP, where you only use send message and receive message, you basically don't have any state. And there you need like a small translation table for those two hooks, where you can then, if the packet goes up, like back to the application to receive message, where you can then rewrite the backend IP with the service, with the virtual service IP, right? Yeah, so I think that's really, really powerful feature and saves overhead. Then the case of node port services. So basically here we have this external client. It tries to connect to a service on the node's IP in the node port range, and the packet arrives on the physical device BPF program, which is sitting there. It does a service lookup, and it is automatically then doing a DNAT to one of the backends. It checks whether Cilium has the knowledge whether the backend is local or remote, and it checks when it's local, then it just redirects it into the pod's network namespace. So that's the trivial case where the backend is basically local to the node. If you have the more complicated stuff where it's remote, again, then you will connect to the same node's IP address where there's the BPF program running, and then it determines, aha, so the backend is not local. I have to go to the remote node, and basically it's doing first a DNAT, and then it's also doing an SNAT. And that SNAT is also done in BPF. So we basically wrote a NAT engine in BPF. It's doing the translation, and when the reply comes back, it has to do all of the reverse SNAT and DNAT and pushing the packet back out. And that basically works. We have it in our Cilium code base merged, and it can go over direct routing or also over a tunnel mesh in Cilium. Yeah, so all done in BPF. Then there's something that's called external traffic policy local in Kubernetes, where you basically say that it can only connect to those backends that are actually local to the node, so you don't take this extra hop, and basically the packet would be dropped in this case if it tries to connect there. And something that we merged just recently in Cilium is also direct server return. So there we basically save the overhead of doing the SNAT. And whenever a service, again, tries to connect to a backend that is remote to the node, basically we encode the service IP so that basically the backend then in BPF can rewrite the packet with the source as the original service IP and can reply directly to the client without going back to the other node for this extra hop. So that's more efficient even. And that all happens inside BPF without any of the other dependencies needed. So we did some performance benchmarking on AWS with SIOV networking and compared basically the whole thing to IP tables and IPvS. And we were running NetPerf TCP CRR. TCP CRR is basically a NetPerf test where you're establishing the TCP handshake, you're exchanging one byte of information, then you're already tearing down the TCP connection, and it's doing this as many times as it can. And we were basically running this against the node port service. And as you can see here with the default baked-in kubeproxy implementation, you're really hitting the limits if you have 2,700 services. That really is noticeable in terms of overhead because you have to traverse all the lists and IP tables. And it's being done for all the new connections, right? And yeah, so the second benchmark is basically the TCP RR, which means that it's creating a TCP connection and then it's only sending one byte of data as a ping pong. And then tearing it down. So you don't have the new connection every time. So you can see here that IP tables is actually performing not as bad as before. But BPF is still the clear winner, and the DSR implementation where you save this extra hop gives you the lowest latency. The other thing that we are currently working on right now is basically to move this extra hop that we had where the backend is remote to the node into the XDP layer. XDP layer is basically another hook for BPF in the system where you can run BPF programs right at the driver layer without even having the overhead of allocating a socket buffer in the Linux kernel, without even having to go through the GRO engine and higher layers. So it's been running at much earlier hook than just the TC ingress. And we can already there, if we determine that the backend is remote, we can already there push it back out the driver again without having to go into higher layers. And all the three cloud providers now, they have finally support. So the last thing that got merged was into the kernel was the ENA driver that it got XDP support, so you can run it also on AWS with SIUV networking. And this chart here is basically from a presentation from NetDevConf from Facebook folks. So they used for a long time IPvS for their main L4 load balancing, and basically they switched all their front-end load balancer to BPF and XDP in production, and they see a much better throughput. So they don't publish concrete numbers, but they said it has a performance gain for 10x and more, which is quite impressive. So yeah, so that's for the Cilium 1.8 release. We have scheduled that to port it into XDP. And basically, to recap, with the whole data path in BPF, you get a much better performance and lower latency. You can have faster service updates because you don't have to go through to the net link, and you don't have to replace the entire blob. And you just do like a BPF system call for updating BPF maps. It's much more reliable. You have less lines of code overall, and you don't need to wait for a new kernel. If you have a fix that you desperately need in production, you can just patch it live, because you can just change the BPF program on the fly. You get much better visibility. I didn't really talk about that in this talk here, but there's something called the perf ring buffer output, where you can basically export custom data to a high performance perf ring buffer, and then collect all of this in user space. And it's not subject to any kernel UAPI restrictions or something. You can really define your custom structs in C that you want to push down there. And then we can also correlate traffic with container traffic, for example. You don't have to shell out to IP tables, and you're able to much more customize your data path. You can change basically the behavior on the fly, which is great. And it's fully integrated with the rest of Cilium. So this aspect only covered the load balancing integration, but there's also policy and much more in Cilium. So yeah, with that said, if you want to try out the kubeproxy free how-to, it's just like 3 or 4 commands to run it. There's a kubeadmin integration where you can deploy kubeadmin without kubeproxy. And then you can basically run Cilium and enable it with a kubeproxy free feature. The code is all on GitHub if you want to check it out. And there's also a Slack community. So yeah. Thanks for that. Are there any?
Do we have questions?
Are there any questions? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. Privilege mode. So does it require privilege mode? So it's working like on a from behind. So you
so
can.
So the question is whether it requires privilege mode or. Yeah. So most of the BPF features, they are in privileged mode. So basically, the Cilium pod that you deploy runs basically on a host namespace as well, and it has to install all the BPF and manage all the BPF, but that's basically privileged. We disable the unprivileged BPF by default. So, yeah.
Other questions? Yeah.
It's the first time that I'm seeing a BPF. If I understood well, it's all in user space, and I'm concerned about security, because you never talk about security. Is it possible for a container to tamper the rules or something similar?
Mm-hmm. So basically, all the BPF programs that are loaded into the kernel, they have to pass a verifier. And the verifier does strict security checks. It checks, for example, whether all the types are sane, whether you don't do out-of-bound access, so basically all the stuff that you cannot crash or destabilize the kernel. And it even goes that far that you've probably heard of all the Spectre stuff. It even goes that far to mitigate potential Spectre issues by rewriting parts of the BPF program that are loaded, but still to keep the logic the same. So it's really doing a lot of work there to make sure everything is sound and safe.
Other questions?
Yeah. So while you're walking, if you want some stickers, there are also some BPF stickers and Cilium stickers.
Somewhere.
Have you done any performance comparison with the kubeproxy free project? When you have a small number of services, but the number of cluster nodes increases, like is there a performance gain there?
So when you have a small number of services, but the number of cluster nodes increases. So there's still a performance gain because the IP tables hook comes at a much later point in the networking stack compared to the TC ingress. So TC ingress is basically run right after GRO is executed, so it's still earlier, and also all the BPF stuff is just in time compiled. It tries to void all the indirect calls as much as possible, as opposed to IP tables. So there's, it's still a better performance, and there's still less overhead in the fast path.
Okay, we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.